You will hear a number of different recordings, and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. There will be time for you to read the instructions and questions, and you will have a chance to check your work. The test is in four sections. At the end of the test, you will be given 10 minutes to transfer your answers to an answer sheet. Now turn to Section 1. Section 1. You will hear a recruitment agent talking to a woman who is looking for a job. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 6. Now listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 6.
Good morning. Arzni, is it? Please have a seat.
Yes, Arzni. Thank you.
How are you doing today? Did you have any trouble finding our agency?
I'm fine, thank you. Actually, it was fairly easy to get here. It's only 5 minutes' walk from the train station.
That's great. Well, let's get started then. I've got a form I need to fill out for my paperwork. Hope you don't mind if I take some notes.
No, not at all.
Great. So your full name is Arzni Middleton. And how would you like us to get hold of you?
Well, I keep my phone with me at all times, but sometimes I may be too busy to answer it. I think emailing is a better solution. I check my email regularly.
By email. Okay, so what's your email address?
It's the first six letters of my surname and then the first two letters of my first name at gmail.com.
That makes it middleaz@gmail.com.
Yes, that's correct.
And you're from Indonesia?
Actually, I'm from Malaysia.
Oh, sorry about that. I'm sure you must get pretty angry when people call you Indonesian. Like Polish people being asked which part of Russia they're from.
Please don't worry about it. It happens to me all the time.
Fine. Now we need to get some references from you. I mentioned it to you yesterday on the phone. We need one reference from your former employer, and the other one must be personal.
Yes, I've brought a reference with me from James Jones, who is my line manager at the Caledonian Hotel, where I worked for 2 years as a hotel receptionist.
Brilliant. So the Caledonian Hotel was your last employer?
Yes, apart from a couple of hours I had in a local pub, but that was just a short-term commitment. I'm sure James will be happy to be my referee if you contact him.
Yes, we may get in touch with him. And did you manage to get a personal reference?
I thought the best person to contact would be my landlord, Teo Olotu, who works in the city centre as a shop assistant. I arrived in Birmingham in September 2008, and since then I've been renting my flat from him. We've known each other for over 5 years now, and I'm sure he can confirm that I'm a trustworthy and reliable person.
Sounds good to me. I believe I have some positions you may be interested in. But first, can you tell me if you have any skills, like using a computer, cooking, anything?
Well, I've got a current health and safety certificate. I had to complete it when I was still working at the hotel.
Oh, good. I also had to complete my training in health and safety. I'm really glad I did it. Anything else I should take a note of?
Let me think. I have an NVQ level 1 in cookery from my college days, but I don't think it's anything special. I can also speak two languages, German and French. My German is only basic, but a year ago I got a certificate in intermediate French. I was over the moon when I passed it.
So you are sort of a, what do we call them? Oh yeah, I know, linguist. You know so many languages.
I love studying languages.
Okay, I will take a note of it then.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, You have some time to look at questions 7 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 7 to 10.
So now, as I have already mentioned to you on the phone, there are three hotel positions you may want to have a closer look at. The best would be to start with the one located very close to our office.
Yes, I jotted it down. That's the Britannia Hotel, which is situated in Birmingham city centre. It's 2 minutes from the Bullring, right?
Yes, that's right. This hotel offers a convenient 24-hour reception, as well as 24-hour room service and a coffee bar. A front desk, parking and a laundry service are only some of the features that this modern hotel has to offer to guests. And they have a position for a receptionist open at the moment, with a salary ranging from £18,000 to £23,000 per annum.
Sounds great. But if I apply for this position, will I need to work night shifts too?
I'm not sure of that. I will need to ring them up and double check. But they also say here that a perfect candidate needs to be fairly flexible, have excellent communication skills and basic IT skills.
That shouldn't be a problem for me.
Good. Now, the next hotel is in the country, near Bristol.
Oh, yeah, the Ramada Hotel?
Exactly. So they have a position for a housekeeping supervisor. The only disadvantage with this hotel is that you would earn at least £3,000 less than at Britannia Hotel, as they offer a maximum pay of £15,000. And to be successful for this role, you must have some work experience in this field and be able to demonstrate a strong management style.
Right. Well, the salary's too low for me, and I have very little experience in this field, I'm afraid.
Fair enough. Luckily, there is one more hotel position you may be interested in. It's in the Apollo Hotel in Wolverhampton. And if you travel by car, it's only half an hour away from Birmingham.
OK, so what's the position?
Actually, they have two vacancies open at the moment. The first one is for a waitress and the second one for an assistant chef. You said that you have some cooking experience, so perhaps we should have a look at the second vacancy.
Yes, of course. Why not?
OK, then. So we are looking here at a salary of £24,000, which is the highest one so far. You mentioned that you have your health and safety certificate, but for this position, you will also need to complete a food hygiene certificate. You should not worry about it, though, since it's written here that the employer is paying for it.
Wow, this sounds perfect. I really love cooking for others.
I'm really happy to hear that. You can have a think about it, and as soon as we've checked your references, we can arrange an interview for you for one of the positions.
Right, I see. Thanks a lot for all your help.
You're welcome.
This is the end of section one. You now have 30 seconds to check your answers. Now turn to section two. Section two. You will hear a radio interview in which an expert gives some tips to college students on what to wear to a job interview. First, you have 30 seconds to look at questions 11 to 15. Now listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 15.
My guest today is Nicole Forrest, career expert for LinkedIn and founder of Doit, one of the leading career consultancy firms in Birmingham. Thank you for being with us today.
Good morning, everyone. I'm glad to be here.
We are going to talk about the job interview dress code. While college students might dress casually in the classroom, they should always dress professionally when interviewing for a professional job or internship. Nicole will give you a few tips on how to select the perfect outfit for a job interview. So, Nicole, where would you like to start?
First of all, I would recommend that you research the company. Before going to an interview, find out how employees at the company dress. This might involve researching the company online or even calling the company and asking before your interview. You can do this by speaking to a company employee, such as a human resource manager, or by asking about the dress code when you arrange an interview appointment.
I see. But how does the dress code differ from one place to another?
Well, appropriate dress standards for business settings vary according to country, culture and industry. Some companies are very conservative in their dress policies and require business attire, while others are more casual. Either way, you should always dress at least slightly more smartly than the employees. If you can't find out how the employees typically dress, it's safest to dress conservatively. It's far better to come to an interview overdressed than underdressed.
I couldn't agree more. We also know that the dress code is different between men and women. Now, have you got any dress code tips for our male audience?
Yes, of course. Men should wear a suit, tie and dress shoes to most interviews. The suit should be a subtle, solid colour, navy and deep grey are best, and shoes should be black or brown. Wear a long-sleeved shirt, either white or another colour that matches your suit, and a smart tie. Small dots or classic stripes work well. Wear black socks so that you will look professional if you cross your ankles. However, if you choose to wear a daring colour, like a red shirt, do it tactfully, making sure the overall design of your outfit is especially conservative.
Right, I see. And how about some tips on shaving and hairstyles?
In fact, not all companies have rigid personal appearance guidelines. It may not be necessary for you to remove a beard for a position in the IT department. IT companies focus more on skills than personal appearance. Other jobs such as journalism, landscaping, architecture, and manufacturing may also be more laid back when it comes to facial hair. If you are applying for one of these jobs and decide to keep your beard, make sure it is properly maintained. Stay away from unusual or overly trendy facial hairstyles. It may be wise to visit a barber to have the beard professionally trimmed and shaped before the interview. It's also easy to overlook hairstyles as part of your preparation. If you are going to work in a more liberal or artistic environment, you may be able to get away with having longer hair. Likewise, if you're applying to work in some other occupation where you aren't in contact with the public, nor working in an office, you may be able to get away with longer hair. If your hair is medium length, you may want to cut it short for your interview process, then grow it back out later once you get the job. Employers are less averse to gradual changes than they are to sudden ones.
Before you hear the rest of the interview, you have some time to look at questions 16 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 16 to 20.
So far, much has been said about the dress code for men. Now, have you got any tips for our female listeners?
Sure. Women have a few more options for professional interview attire. A suit with a blouse is most appropriate for a professional interview. The suit should be a neutral colour, such as navy, dark grey or black. The shirt or blouse can be any colour that matches the suit, but is not too bright or loudly patterned. It's important to make sure the blouse is not low cut. If you feel at all concerned that it is too revealing, I would not recommend wearing it.
Which makeup looks work well for an interview and which don't?
I once interviewed a job candidate who was wearing so many layers of black false lashes that they were falling into her eyes every time she blinked. Needless to say, it was pretty distracting. In terms of interview-appropriate makeup, what you don't wear is often just as important as what you do. The key to interview makeup is to keep it simple. This isn't the time to experiment with your style. If you normally wear a lipstick, wear it. However, if you're new to it, skip it. You don't want to risk it wearing off or rubbing onto your teeth or a coffee mug.
So, what's the best way to project professionalism with your hairstyle? Should you get a ponytail or pull your hair back into a bun?
Personally, I'm a huge fan of getting a ponytail. It gives me that extra boost of confidence. Everyone gains their confidence in different ways. If you can work a great bun, wrap it up. Whatever hairstyle you choose, make sure you look neat and tidy.
And if someone has a nervous habit of, say, playing with her hair, what's the best way to minimise this during an interview?
First of all, many people are unaware of their nervous habits. I'd recommend doing a mock interview with a friend and filming your responses and studying your body language. If you do play with your hair, maybe you should put your hair up in a bun to resist the temptation. Picking random things up is also a pretty common nervous habit. Try holding a pen or portfolio during the interview to keep your hands busy.
Any other do's or don'ts?
Don't be heavy-handed when you apply your fragrance and make sure it is a subtle selection. If you aren't sure how to style yourself for the interview, you should research the company. Look up company employees on LinkedIn. Study their profile photos. How are they wearing their hair? What type of makeup are they wearing? You can learn a lot about presentation from these profiles. And finally, stay away from lots of jewellery. One simple pair of earrings and a watch is sufficient.
Okay, that's all the time we have, so we will leave it there. I would like to thank my guest, who always looks professional, no matter what day of the week it is. Thanks for listening.
This is the end of section 2. You now have 30 seconds to check your answers. Now turn to Section 3. Section 3. You will hear a guest speaker talking to prospective BCU students. First, you have 30 seconds to look at questions 21 to 25. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 25.
Good morning, everyone. I'm delighted to be with you today and to have the chance to introduce our guest speaker, Christine Davis. Christine left Birmingham City University nearly 2 years ago with a degree in jewellery and silversmithing. She's one of the most outstanding graduate students we've ever had, and she's with us today to share her experience of studying at the School of Jewellery. As most of you are planning to start your studies at the Birmingham Institute of Art and Design, I'm sure you'll have plenty of questions. So let's kick off by asking Christine why she chose to study at BCU.
Thank you, Simon. I'm glad to be here with you today. After completing my internship in Ireland, I knew there was only one place I wanted to study to become a professional juror, which was Birmingham's jury quarter. Of course, before choosing BCU, I did plenty of research to see what other universities out there were offering, but it didn't take me long to realise that there was nowhere in the world like the jury quarter.
But did you feel the same about your studies after finishing the first year of your course?
Actually, I was extremely happy with my choice. I couldn't see myself living anywhere else. Everything I needed was right here on my doorstep. If any of my tools broke, I could go out and get replacements immediately. The place where I shaped my silver jewellery was around the corner, and I could buy polished gems there as well. It was all based around a small triangle. I couldn't believe how great the facilities were.
Great advertisement for our services, I think. I'm also interested to know what inspires you when you design jewellery.
Most of my designs are influenced by my new home city. It was during the second year of my degree that I came up with my personal design concepts. Birmingham was undergoing a lot of redevelopment at the time, and I noticed the shapes in the building work that was going on in the city. I tried to use the geometry and lines from these structures when creating my pieces.
That's very interesting. I've also been wondering if it was hard for you to find a job after graduation.
In fact, I had always wanted to start up my own business, but in the previous economic climate, it was a challenge for anyone, so I had to consider other prospects. Initially, I was helped by my jewellery mentor. He offered me 15 hours of paid tuition. I also became an artist in residence at the School of Jewellery, where I was allowed access to some of the workshops in return for lecturing once a week. So, as you can see, it wasn't easy at the beginning, but thanks to the support of my mentor, I was able to keep on chasing my dreams.
So, what module did you teach when you first started?
I started with a set of workshops on the fundamental techniques used when making jewellery. I'm sure that most of you know that the methods for creating jewellery have remained constant throughout time. The Jewellery Quarter Museum has a jeweller's bench from 1899, and you can see how jewellery was made at that time. Many of the jewellery school students smile when they see it, as the methods really haven't changed. We're still essentially using the same techniques when making jewellery. Buyout students are always welcome to bring visitors into any of the workshops run by me to see jewellery being made in the same way that it was years ago.
Before you hear the rest of the discussion, you have some time to look at questions 26 to 30. Now listen carefully and answer questions 26 to 30.
I've heard that it's not easy to purchase materials to create jewellery. Is that true?
Well, not really. The first thing I usually order is silver. I use a company called NextGen, which has been based in the Jewellery Quarter for more than 25 years. My gem supplier is also nearby.
So, which gemstones do you think are the best for you in jewellery design?
That's a good question. I normally use semi-precious stones, including topaz and garnets, which I buy from Shipton & Co. The firm employs the Jewellery Quarter's last working gemstone polisher, Alan Cleverly. I personally think it's great having someone like him so nearby. He's one of the last in the country. Much of the gemstone polishing is done in Thailand and India now. I would have to travel there to buy my stones if he wasn't here.
I know that you need to use the right tools for jewellery making, which can get pretty expensive. Do you know where to get cheaper ones?
Yes, you're right. The tools can get pretty pricey. In order to create my jewellery, I use a specialist set of tools. I buy most of my equipment from H.S. Walsh & Sons, which has been based in the Jewellery Quarter for nearly 20 years. They always have deals to encourage our students to purchase jewellery tools from them. From what I remember, they offer some significant discounts to our students, so perhaps it would be a good idea for you to check them out.
I will have a look at what they've got for sure. Could you also tell me if there is a place where you can test and hallmark precious metal items before selling them?
Once my jewellery is completed, I get my work trademarked and stamped with my own mark at Birmingham SA office, also within walking distance of the School of Jewellery. It is the largest of its kind in the world and tests and hallmarks precious metals as required by the Hallmarking Act.
I've been trying to guess how much of British jewellery is still produced in the Jewellery Quarter. Is it 60% by any chance?
Well, in the late 90s, that would have been a very good guess. However, the latest statistics show that this percentage has dropped to 40%. Most British jewellery is sold elsewhere, and many of the shops sell gems that are brought in from somewhere else. There's only one shop in the jewellery quarter that sells products made by the local jewellers, Artful Expressions.
So that is where you sell all your products, right?
Actually, most of my products are sold online, but I do also sell some items through Artful Expressions. They've had a shop here for over 20 years, and they only sell jewellery that has been made in the jewellery quarter. Customers from all over the world visit this shop. They really like it when they can buy jewellery that has been made locally.
I'm afraid we're running out of time now. Thank you, Christine, for your time.
Thank you, Simon. It was my pleasure to be here with all of you today.
This is the end of Section 3. You now have 30 seconds to check your answers. Now turn to Section 4. Section 4. You will listen to a university lecture on body language. First, you have 1 minute to look at questions 31 to 40. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Body language is often studied and observed in order to gain a better understanding and appreciation of a person's thoughts and feelings in a particular situation. Although understanding body language isn't a guaranteed method for uncovering somebody's personal emotions, it often proves useful in allowing you to get a general idea about a person's mental state and reaction to the immediate situation. It has often been suggested that a person's eye movements reveal information related to imagination and dishonesty. For instance, if an individual tends to look to the right when speaking, this is associated with the notion that his or her mind is creating something. This creation isn't necessarily lying, as in some contexts, this can be associated with producing an idea or an imaginative thought. Eye movement has also been used to determine when a person is frustrated or showing excitement. The second type of nonverbal communication deals with the study of the mouth. As the mouth is fundamentally linked with language and expression, it is often studied by body language interpreters. For example, when a person expresses a tight-lipped smile, noticeable for being straight and not exposing the teeth, it indicates that something is being kept secret, often because this person doesn't trust other people around. Facial movement reveals feelings of self-comfort, tension, or frustration, depending on the expression. The third type of body language refers to arms, which are a particularly interesting element, as they're often specifically noticed in relation to a person demonstrating feelings of nervousness or insecurity. only in one notable instance, when hands and arms are held behind a person's back, do they actively suggest confidence. Defensive arm movements are related to blocking the person's body from the other person. These include folding arms, holding objects in front of the chest, and adjusting bracelets or watches, among others. And finally, we get to the hands, which are thought to be the most studied aspect of body language, as their use for communicating is incomparable to any other part of the body. In contrast with other aspects of body language, movement of the hands is said to suggest a huge range of feelings and states. For example, pulling the ear can signal indecision. Cracking knuckles can signal the desire for attention, and open palms can suggest openness. So, why is the study of body language so important? Well, body language is something that is noticed by nearly everybody, but is not always given enough attention. We sometimes ignore it and try to hide behind words, but we should never forget that we cannot fool everyone. Interestingly, in 2010, psychological expert James Borg claimed that 93% of human communication was by body language and only 7% via words. And now, a notable feature of the early years of the 21st century is the fact that the non-verbal communication of different nations is gradually becoming more similar. Thus, a gesture made by someone in, let's say, South America can often be easily interpreted by people in Russia or Japan. Much of this is not due to the internet or travelling, but thanks to the effects of TV, which of course shows the same sort of soap operas in all parts of the globe. However, there are some exceptions. It has recently been claimed that the well-known scuba divers' forefinger and thumb OK gesture, which is used in France and most of Europe to mean things are good, is deeply offensive to people in Brazil. Similarly, British doctors have learned that it's not a good idea to offer a reassuring wink to Asian patients, many of whom see this as a sexual gesture. Even more complicated is the area of touching, which means different things to different people. If you touch the wrong person on the wrong part of the body or at an improper time, your reputation can be at risk. In general, females are more comfortable with touching than males, perhaps due to their maternal role. Males usually prefer a brief touch, because otherwise they might feel that their masculinity is at risk. In addition, different cultures have different codes when it comes to the amount of touch that is socially acceptable and how it should be done. That's why it's important to check the local customs when visiting foreign countries to avoid offending or being offended by the locals. It's also interesting to see how our body language evolves as we grow, because it changes quickly to adapt to our social environment. People learn to express the same emotions and attitudes as they did as children, only with much more subtlety and self-control, especially in societies where it's not appropriate to express feelings publicly. Defensive body language is a good example of this. Little children who feel insecure often hide behind a piece of furniture or their mother's skirt, seeking refuge or protection. As they mature, however, they cannot use these obvious and inappropriate means to cover their lack of confidence, so they create other artificial barriers to help them feel more secure. Perhaps you hold your hands close to your face when you have a conversation. Generally, this is a sign of insecurity. The same is true if you roll a beard or moustache with your fingertips, or fix your hair, perhaps pushing or curling it behind an ear.
That is the end of Section 4. You now have 30 seconds to check your answers. This is the end of Section 4 and the end of the recording. You now have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to the listening answer sheet. Please do this carefully. You have 1 minute left. Please put your pencils down. That is the end of the test.